All right, so get this. You sent us this whole stack of research, and it's all about functional landscapes for biodiversity in Sweden specifically. Sounds kind of complicated, to be honest.
Yeah, it can be a bit much.
But that's why we're here, right?
Exactly.
To break it down, help everyone understand how we can actually create landscapes that support a thriving natural world.
That's the goal.
Yeah, like what does that even mean?
Right.
Functional landscapes.
Yeah.
Before we dive in, though, we should mention that Sweden is mostly forests.
That's true.
With just a little bit of grassland and urban areas mixed in.
Right. So that context is key.
It totally shapes the conversation about biodiversity.
Absolutely.
So whether you're prepping for some big meeting on this or just brushing up on your ecology knowledge, or maybe you're just curious about how nature does its thing in different places.
All good reasons to be here.
We've got you covered.
We'll try our best.
So let's start with the basics.
Okay.
What are functional landscapes anyway?
That's a great question. And
like, what does it even mean?
There's no one size fits all answer, really.
Okay.
But we're basically talking about designing landscapes that go beyond just letting different species survive.
Mm-hmm.
It's about letting them thrive.
Thrive.
Long term.
So like, what does that look like?
Well, it's about figuring out what each species needs from its environment and then building a landscape that can actually deliver on those needs.
So it's not just like preserving random patches of nature here and there.
No, it's a much more intentional approach.
They're more deliberate.
You got it.
The research we've been looking at keeps mentioning scale.
Right.
How does scale fit into this whole functional landscapes thing?
Well, think of it this way.
Okay.
A woodpecker needs a big chunk of mature forest
mm-hmm.
to find enough food and good nesting spots.
Yeah, makes sense.
But a butterfly might be perfectly content with a small meadow.
So it's about recognizing that different species have different needs.
It's in different ranges,
And we have to accommodate all of that variety.
Exactly.
That sounds pretty complicated.
It can be, yeah.
So how do we even begin to design a landscape that works for so many different species?
One way to think about it is to imagine these different patches of islands.
Of islands.
Yeah, like a meadow in the middle of a forest would be like an island of grassland.
Oh, I see.
Surrounded by a sea of trees.
Right.
And there's this ecological theory called island biogeography
mm-hmm.
that can help us understand how the size of that island and how far away it is from other similar islands affects its ability to support a species over a long period of time.
So you're saying like just having a patch of habitat isn't always enough.
That's right.
It could be too small.
It could be too small.
Or too far away from other similar habitats.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the species living there might struggle to find mates or enough resources, and they might be more vulnerable to like disease or predators.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So it's not just about having a patch of habitat. It's about the size.
Yes.
The quality and how well those patches are connected.
Got it.
That's making me rethink how I view landscapes.
It's a different way of seeing things.
It really is.
And that brings us to another concept called metapopulation theory.
Metapopulation theory.
Yeah, and this looks at how...
What is that?
It's about how those smaller patches of habitat can actually work together to support a species across a much larger landscape.
Interesting.
So instead of just one big protected area, you have a network of smaller habitats with individuals moving between them.
Like a network of islands.
Exactly.
And that can actually reduce the risk of extinction for a species.
Right.
Wow. That's fascinating.
It's all about connections.
So we're not just protecting individual areas.
Yeah.
We're thinking about how they function together as a whole.
It's a bigger picture view.
That's a great way to put it.
And the research talks about two main approaches.
Okay, like two different strategies.
Yeah, for identifying and managing these functional landscapes.
What are they?
The first one is habitat-based.
Habitat-based.
And the second is species-based.
All right, can you break those down for us?
Sure.
Like, what's the difference?
Well, the habitat-based approach
focuses
on protecting and managing specific types of habitats.
So, like, what kind of habitats are we talking about?
Like forests, grasslands, wetlands, that kind of thing.
So it's like, if we protect this specific type of environment, we're also protecting a lot of the species that live there.
Exactly.
That seems pretty efficient. Right?
It can be, yeah.
Like covering a lot of ground at once.
Mm-hmm.
So what about the species-based approach?
Well, that one gets a lot more specific.
Okay.
It really focuses in on the needs of individual species.
like each individual species.
Or groups of species that have similar needs.
Oh.
So it's much more targeted.
No, that makes sense.
But it also requires a lot more knowledge.
More research.
Yeah, about each species and how their needs are being met.
It's like one approach is broad, like protecting the stage where a play happens.
Mm-hmm. I like
that. And the other is very specific.
Right.
Like focusing on each actor in the play and what they need.
That's a fantastic way to put it.
So both approaches have their pluses and minuses.
Definitely.
Habitat-based might be more efficient.
Yeah.
But it could miss some of those specialized species.
That's a good point.
And species-based is more targeted.
Uh-huh.
But it could be really resource intensive.
That's true.
Makes sense.
And all of these reports actually dive into all of this plays out in specific Swedish landscapes.
So let's get into that.
Sure.
Forests are a big part of Sweden, right?
Huge, yeah.
So let's start there.
Okay.
What are some of the challenges of creating a functional forest landscape?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is balancing timber production with biodiversity conservation.
Because we need timber.
It's a major economic activity.
But we also want to protect the forests for all the other benefits they provide.
Right. For biodiversity, climate regulation, recreation.
It's like walking a tightrope.
It is. It's about finding that balance.
And I imagine that balance isn't always easy to find.
No, it requires careful consideration and a willingness to compromise.
So what kind of things get overlooked when we're focused on timber production?
One important factor that often gets missed is the importance of naturalness.
Naturalness.
It's not just about having trees.
Right.
It's about having a diversity of tree ages and structures,
right,
including older trees, which provide unique habitats that are often lacking in managed forests.
It's like a well-balanced orchestra.
Hmm, that's a great analogy.
You need all the different instruments playing together.
Yes.
To create a rich and resilient sound.
And a natural forest is the same way.
With young trees and old trees and all different species.
Hmm. Exactly. It creates a much more resilient and diverse ecosystem.
So a managed forest, where all the trees are the same age and the same type, it's kind of like an orchestra with only one instrument.
Exactly. It might sound okay at first.
But it's not as interesting.
And it's definitely not as resilient.
And then there's the whole issue of deadwood.
Ah, yes, deadwood.
Like fallen trees and branches.
Yeah, all of that.
Why is that important?
It might seem like just debris.
I mean, it doesn't look very pretty.
But it's actually essential habitat.
Oh, wow.
For a huge variety of insects, fungi.
Really?
Even certain birds and mammals rely on deadwood.
Okay, that's interesting.
Did you know that one study found?
What's that?
That the amount of deadwood in streams could actually predict how many brown trout were there.
Wait, deadwood in a stream?
Yeah.
What does that have to do with fish?
It shows how interconnected these seemingly separate habitats can be.
Oh, I see.
Those insects that live in the deadwood eventually fall into the stream, and they become food for the trout.
Wow. I never thought about it that way.
It's a reminder that even small elements of a landscape can have a big impact.
Yeah, like a ripple effect.
Exactly.
I guess we really need to rethink our ideas about what a clean forest should look like.
Sometimes a little messiness can actually be a good thing.
I'm starting to see that.
It's about seeing the forest for all its complexity.
Okay, let's move on from forests for a bit.
All right.
What about grasslands?
Grasslands are fascinating.
The research mentions that they've been declining in Sweden.
Yeah, that's a big concern.
So why are grasslands so important?
Imagine walking through a vibrant meadow.
Okay.
Buzzing with life.
Yeah.
That's the magic of grasslands.
They're beautiful.
They support so many specialized species.
They can't survive anywhere else.
Exactly.
What happens when those grasslands disappear?
Well, we lose not just the habitat. But all those unique species that depend on them.
It's like a chain reaction.
It is. And a lot of this decline is due to changes in land use.
Like
intensive agriculture.
Okay.
And the decline of traditional grazing practices.
So we're losing those open, grassy environments.
And all the species that depend on them.
One of the reports uses a really interesting example to illustrate this.
Oh, which one?
The gull vifgerl.
The gull-wing butterfly.
Yeah, it's a beautiful butterfly.
And it totally depends on the cowslip plant for survival.
Cowslip.
Yeah, Primula veris, the plant is called.
But it's not just any cowslip that'll do, right?
You're right. They're picky eaters.
What do they like?
The butterflies prefer those larger, more nutritious cowslip plants.
Okay.
And they need them to be clustered together.
So it's not just about having the right plant species.
No.
It's about the quality and distribution of those plants.
Exactly.
Even within a grassland, there's so much complexity.
But we need to understand.
Yeah, if we want to support those specialized species.
Absolutely.
It's a good reminder that even small habitats can be incredibly valuable.
Especially if they're managed well.
Like those little pockets of grassland.
They're critical pieces of the overall biodiversity puzzle.
Okay, so we've talked about forests and grasslands.
What's next?
What about agricultural landscapes?
That's a tough one.
Can farmland even be a haven for wildlife?
It's a good question and a challenging one.
Because agriculture can be pretty intense, right?
It has definitely had a negative impact on biodiversity.
Like how so?
Think about larger fields, fewer hedgerows, more pesticides.
All of that is tough on wildlife.
Especially birds.
So it's a balancing act.
It is.
Trying to produce the food we need.
Right.
But also creating space for wildlife to thrive.
We have to find a way to make agriculture more hospitable to biodiversity.
Are there ways to do that?
There are, and they involve things like...
Okay. Like what?
Maintaining hedgerows.
Okay.
Creating field margins with wildflowers,
mm-hmm.
and leaving small patches of natural habitat within the fields.
It's about creating a more diverse landscape, right?
Exactly. A more diverse mosaic.
Instead of just vast stretches of a single crop.
Right, like offering a buffet instead of a single dish.
I like that.
You'll attract a lot more diners that way.
So instead of a monoculture, we're going for a multicultural landscape.
You got it.
And this also brings up the issue of different types of species.
How so?
Well, some species do well in those fragmented habitats,
mm-hmm.
but others need those larger, more connected areas.
You're absolutely right.
So there's a trade-off there.
There is.
Trying to create a mosaic might benefit some species,
mm-hmm.
but harm others that need larger, undisturbed areas.
It's a constant challenge.
Just finding that balance.
Between generalists and specialists.
Okay, so we've talked about forests, grasslands, and agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
What about a landscape that's often overlooked when we talk about biodiversity?
Which one's that?
Urban environments.
Ah, say
what makes them unique in this whole functional landscapes context?
Well, they're fascinating because they're totally shaped by human activity.
Right, they're human-made.
Yet they can still support a surprising amount of biodiversity.
That is surprising.
It's all about how we design and manage those spaces.
So instead of seeing cities as concrete jungles, we can see them as potential ecosystems.
That's the idea.
What does a functional urban landscape even look like?
That's a question a lot of researchers are exploring.
Okay.
It's not just about having lots of green space.
It's about how we manage those spaces.
Right, and how we connect them.
And even thinking about how buildings can be more wildlife friendly.
That's right. It's about weaving nature into the fabric of the city.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
And the way we manage those green spaces has a huge impact.
Oh, really?
There was a study in Malmö, Sweden that found that butterfly diversity actually went way down in parks that were really well maintained.
You mean like manicured parks?
Yeah.
Compared to areas that were left a little more wild.
Exactly.
So a messy park is better for butterflies.
It seems counterintuitive.
It does.
But all that maintenance.
Like mowing and raking.
Yeah, it actually eliminates a lot of the resources that butterflies need.
So they need those fallen leaves and branches.
They do. It's like we're so used to equating neatness with good that we forget that nature actually thrives on a little bit of chaos.
It's true.
Even in a city, a little messiness can be a good thing.
So what about the plants we choose?
That's another huge factor.
The types of plants we plant in our cities.
Yeah.
Does that make a difference for biodiversity?
It makes a huge difference.
So.
Think about it. Native plants have evolved with the local wildlife for thousands of years.
Right.
They provide the right food and shelter and nesting sites.
They're adapted to the local conditions.
Exactly. But exotic plants might look pretty,
mm-hmm.
but they often don't offer the same resources.
So planting native trees and flowers is like setting the table for local wildlife.
It is. And when you support those insects and other invertebrates, you're also supporting the birds and bats and other animals that rely on them.
It's all connected.
It's all about creating that balanced urban ecosystem.
So the choices we make in our own backyards can actually make a difference.
Every little bit helps.
For the entire urban food web.
That's the idea.
This has been really eye-opening.
It's a fascinating topic.
We've gone from defining what functional landscapes even means
mm-hmm.
to understanding how different ecological theories can help us design them.
And we've even looked at...
And then we zoomed into those specific challenges and opportunities in different Swedish landscapes.
Right.
What's next in our deep dive?
Well, we've talked a lot about the concepts and the goals.
Yeah.
But now let's get into how scientists actually measure.
Okay.
And monitor.
What? Measure and monitor what?
Whether a landscape is actually functioning well for biodiversity.
I can't wait to learn more about that.
It's more than just counting trees, I promise.
I'm intrigued. We'll be right back after a quick break. Okay, welcome back.
Back again.
We've been exploring this whole idea of functional landscapes.
Right.
And I'm curious about the practical side of things.
Yeah.
How do we actually measure if a landscape is working well for biodiversity?
That's a great question.
Like, we can't just pull out a ruler, right?
Not quite, no.
It's got to be way more complicated than that.
It is, yeah.
To really understand how a landscape is functioning for all those different species,
mm-hmm.
we need a lot of information.
We do.
So what kind of information are we talking about?
Well, we need to look at a lot of data sources.
Data sources.
And what we call indicators.
Okay, like what kind of data?
Well, field observations are definitely part of it.
So scientists are out there with clipboards, like counting everything.
Scientists do go out and conduct surveys.
Okay.
To track the abundance and distribution of different species.
So they're literally counting how many butterflies are in a meadow.
Sometimes, yeah.
Or how many woodpeckers are in a forest.
It can be pretty labor intensive.
That sounds like a lot of work.
But thankfully, there's more to the story than just boots on the ground observations.
Oh, okay. What else is there?
Researchers also use things like habitat mapping.
Habitat mapping.
Remote sensing data from satellites.
Wow.
And even genetic analysis.
It's like old school field work meets cutting edge technology.
It's a combination of approaches.
So what is habitat mapping exactly?
Imagine creating a detailed map that shows all the different types of habitats in a landscape.
Like a blueprint of the landscape.
Kind of, but instead of roads and buildings,
yeah.
we're highlighting the features that are essential for biodiversity.
So like, where are the forests?
Right.
Where are the grasslands?
The wetlands, even urban green spaces.
And these maps help us assess how much suitable habitat is out there for different species.
Exactly, and how it's distributed across the landscape.
And then the satellite data gives us even more information.
Right, satellites can capture images of huge areas,
right.
which lets us track things like deforestation, urban sprawl.
We can see how the landscape is changing over time.
And those changes can tell us a lot about how biodiversity might be impacted.
Wow, that's incredible.
And then there's genetic analysis.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier.
What's cool about that is it's like unlocking a secret code.
A secret code?
That tells us how connected different populations of a species are.
How does that work?
By analyzing the DNA of individuals from different areas.
Okay.
We can see how much gene flow there is between them.
Gene flow?
It's about whether individuals from different areas are interbreeding.
So like, are those populations isolated?
Or are they mingling and mixing their genes?
That's amazing. We can actually see that.
We can.
It's like tracing the invisible pathways that connect different parts of the landscape.
Using genetics as our guide.
That's a great way to put it.
And all of this data.
The field observations, the habitat maps, the satellite imagery, the genetics.
It all feeds into developing what we call indicators.
Okay, indicators.
Which help us assess how functional a landscape really is.
So indicators are like the dashboard warning lights.
That's a good analogy.
They tell us if the landscape is running smoothly or if something needs attention.
Mm.
So what are some examples of these indicators?
Well, there are a lot of different types.
Okay.
Some measure the structural features of a landscape.
Structural features.
Things like the amount of habitat, the size of patches, the degree of connectivity.
So those are giving us information about the physical layout of the landscape.
Exactly.
How much forest is there?
Right.
How big are those patches of grassland?
And are they connected or isolated?
Oh, okay.
Those are all important structural features.
And those features are directly linked to how well a landscape can support biodiversity, right?
Often, yes.
But I imagine that functionality isn't just about the physical structure.
You're right.
It's also about how those structures are being used.
And how species are interacting within them.
Exactly.
And that's where functional indicators come in.
Functional indicators.
These focus on the ecological processes happening within a landscape.
Like what kind of processes?
Things like pollination, seed dispersal, the regulation of pests and diseases.
So it's not enough to just know that a forest is there.
Right, right.
We need to know if the trees are producing seeds.
If those seeds are being spread to new areas.
If there are enough pollinators.
To keep the whole system going.
It's like we're measuring the pulse and vital signs of the landscape.
That's a great way to think about it.
And to get the most complete picture,
yeah,
scientists use a combination of both structural and functional indicators.
Along with data on where different species are found?
So it's like a giant puzzle.
It is, in a way.
And these different pieces of information fitting together.
To tell us the story of how the landscape is functioning.
The reports also mention something called composite indicators.
Oh, yeah. Those are interesting.
What are those all about?
Composite indicators are a way of combining multiple indicators into a single overall measure of functionality.
So it's like taking a complicated scorecard and distilling it down to a simple grade.
That's a good analogy.
Like an A+ for a really functional landscape.
Or a C for one that's struggling.
But even those composite indicators are a simplification, right?
They are. They can be useful for tracking trends and identifying areas that need attention.
But they don't tell the whole story.
It's important to remember that.
Oh, it's a good starting point.
Yes.
But we still need to dig deeper to get the full picture.
Absolutely.
I was really fascinated by how these reports applied all of these concepts to specific examples.
Oh, yeah. They had some great examples.
Like in Sweden, they talked about how even small patches of habitat can be important.
Right, like those power line corridors.
Power line corridors.
Yeah, those areas that are cleared to make way for power lines.
I always thought those were bad for wildlife.
Well, it turns out they can actually be beneficial.
Really? How so?
Well, compared to the dense forest around them, those corridors tend to have more open, sunny areas.
I see.
And that creates conditions that are similar to meadows and grasslands.
So it's like an accidental meadow.
Exactly.
Created by human activity.
And they can also act as connections between fragmented patches of habitat.
So those corridors can actually help butterflies and other species move across the landscape.
That's the idea.
Wow, I never would have thought of that.
It shows that we need to be creative.
Yeah.
And see the potential for biodiversity, even in unexpected places.
It's like acknowledging that nature is resilient.
And adaptable.
Even in the face of human activity.
And if we understand what different species need.
Yeah.
We can find ways to work with nature rather than against it.
That's the whole point of functional landscapes, right?
It is. Working with nature to create landscapes that support both human well-being and a thriving web of life.
This has been a fascinating look at how scientists measure and assess those landscapes.
It's been a great discussion.
We've learned about the data, the indicators, and how even those seemingly disturbed areas can be important for biodiversity.
It's all about shifting our perspective.
It is, but I have to imagine that actually creating these functional landscapes isn't always easy.
You're right about that.
There must be tough choices and compromises involved.
Absolutely. Creating functional landscapes isn't just a scientific challenge.
It's a human one, too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in the final part of our deep dive, we'll explore those complex trade-offs.
I'm looking forward to that. Welcome back to our deep dive into functional landscapes. We've been talking about defining the concept and how scientists measure landscape functionality. But creating these landscapes, it's not always simple, is it?
No, you're right about that. There are definitely some real-world trade-offs to consider.
And challenges.
Challenges too, yeah.
The research mentions that it often involves tough choices between different goals.
Exactly. We're not just looking at ecological data.
It's more than that.
It's about human values, economic interests, and often competing priorities.
So let's get into those messy real-world dilemmas.
Right.
You mentioned trade-offs.
Yeah.
Can you give us some examples?
Sure. A classic example is forest management.
Forest management. Okay.
We want to conserve forests for their biodiversity,
thanks,
their role in regulating the climate, their beauty, their recreational value.
All important things.
But we also rely on them for timber production.
Right. Timber is a huge economic activity.
Exactly. So it's about finding that balance.
Between ecological and economic benefits.
That's a great way to put it.
And I imagine that balance isn't always easy to find.
No, it often involves compromise.
So what factors come into play?
When deciding how to manage a landscape.
Yeah.
Well, we need to consider the ecological value.
Okay.
The economic benefits of different land uses.
All right.
The social and cultural significance of the landscape.
That's a lot to consider.
And even the potential impacts of climate change.
It's a complex equation.
It is.
Trying to integrate all of those different perspectives.
It's finding solutions that are sustainable.
And sometimes what seems like a win-win situation can actually have unintended consequences.
That's true.
Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. Imagine a community decides to promote tourism by creating new hiking trails through a forest.
That sounds nice.
It seems like a win-win, right?
Yeah. Boosting the economy.
And encouraging people to enjoy nature.
What could be the downside?
Well, those trails, even though they're for recreation,
yeah,
they could actually fragment the habitat.
Oh, I see.
For certain species.
Making it harder for them to move around.
And find the resources they need.
So even a well-intentioned effort to promote nature could end up harming it.
It highlights the need to be really careful about the impacts of our actions.
Even when those actions seem aligned with our goals.
Exactly.
How do we make more informed decisions?
One important step is to involve everyone who has a stake in the landscape.
Like who?
Local communities.
Okay.
Landowners, scientists, conservation organizations, policymakers.
Just bringing everyone to the table.
And having an open and honest conversation.
About the different needs and values.
It's also essential to be transparent about the trade-offs.
Right, because there might not be a perfect solution.
That satisfies everyone completely.
The research also suggests that focusing on specific ecosystem functions can be more effective.
Oh, interesting.
Than trying to conserve every single species or habitat.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, sometimes we need to prioritize.
Okay.
Instead of trying to save everything,
yeah,
we might need to focus on those aspects of biodiversity that are crucial for a healthy ecosystem.
Can you give us an example?
Let's say we're managing an agricultural landscape.
Okay.
And we want to support pollinators.
Which are important for our food supply.
Right. So it might be more effective to focus on the specific pollinators that are most important for the crops we're growing.
Instead of trying to support every single pollinator species.
It's about being strategic.
Focusing our efforts where they'll have the biggest impact.
Exactly.
But choosing what to prioritize, that sounds pretty sensitive.
It can be.
How do we make those decisions?
That's why it's so important to involve everyone in these discussions.
And to use the best scientific evidence available.
To guide our decisions, yes.
This brings us to another challenge mentioned in the research.
Okay, what's that?
Bridging the gap between science and decision making.
That's a big one.
It's not always easy to translate that complex data
into practical management strategies.
So scientists need to find ways to communicate their findings
to the people making the decisions about how land is used.
It sounds like we need a lot more collaboration.
We do.
Between scientists, policymakers, and communities.
If we want to make this vision of functional landscapes a reality.
It's a collective effort.
It is, and it requires a shared understanding of what we want our landscapes to look like.
And how we want them to function for both people and nature.
That's it.
Well, this has been incredible.
It has.
We've explored so much.
We've gone from defining functional landscapes.
To understanding how they're measured.
And all the challenges involved in creating them.
What's the one key takeaway you hope our listener walks away with?
I think the most important message is that creating functional landscapes is a journey.
A journey, not a destination.
Exactly. It's an ongoing process.
The learning, adapting, and working together.
Landscapes are dynamic, they're complex.
And managing them for biodiversity.
Requires a holistic approach.
Considering the needs of everyone.
Both human and non-human.
That's a powerful message.
It is.
It makes me feel both challenged and hopeful.
I understand that.
Challenged by the complexity of it all.
Uh-huh.
But hopeful that we can create landscapes that are truly functional.
That support a thriving natural world for generations to come.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Into the world of functional landscapes.
We hope it sparked your curiosity.
And inspired you to see the world around you in a new way.
Until next time.
Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep diving deep.